It's Song Talk Radio with Michael, Neil, Phil, and the gang.
Good evening, everybody, and starting again. See, we couldn't do this on the radio, but I'll do this now.
I might just keep it anyway, Phil.
So people know what you really like.
You have the
power
of the edit, after all.
I hate you all.
We love you, too.
Good evening, everybody, or afternoon, or wherever or whenever you happen to be. We are so glad you could join us here on this here podcast, because without you, we're just a bunch of nerds in a room. This is the podcast where we share tips on songwriting and other things, songwritery. And we hope that you'll learn at least three things on how to write better songs from listening to this here show. And you can call me Phil, but I'm not here all alone. Along with me, as always, are the very dedicated members of the Song Talk Radio Action team. I think we'll be getting some action figures soon. Mr. Neil Modi, how you doing, Neil?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much.
And on my left is Mr. Michael Proudfoot.
Hello, Phil, Neil, and special guest. Nice to be here.
But wait, there's more. It's not just us.
Along Ginsu with us knives? Do we have Ginsu knives?
But wait, there's more. Just add water and mix, and you get the song studio head, songwriting master, and unofficial member of the Song Talk Radio Action Team. Blair Packham is back here. Hey, Blair.
Hey. Hi, everybody.
How you doing?
I'm good. Good. You guys seem great.
Yeah. So long since we've seen you. I hope you've had a good summer so far.
Well, considering the circumstances we're under, yes, I would say so. Yeah.
Have you found, actually, you've had more time to write in the last little while than you had before?
Yeah, I've been more creative, whether it's writing or producing the recordings that I'm making. Yeah, I've definitely had more time for that. You know, I've also had more time for exercise, and I haven't done any of that. So, you know, there is, you can have more time and still not do the thing you think you should be doing. So, but I've been writing a little bit. I've got a couple of new songs that I'm not, you know, ready to play for anybody because I haven't done them, and I like to really feel comfortable playing.
Can I just ask you, how do you know when the song is done for you anyway? Is there certain things you look for? Is it just a feeling? What?
It's a feeling more than anything. I mean, I like the song to be a nice balance of head and heart in terms of where it's coming from. I you know, so I want to make sure that I've structured it in a way that supports the meaning of the song. I like consistent rhyme schemes and stuff like that. You know, I like that stuff. I don't slavishly follow that stuff. I really don't, even though I'm a songwriting teacher. But if something's not working, the structure is one of the first things I look at. Sometimes I just get sick of a song. There are songs I've recorded that when I play them live, I always think, oh, I really got to rewrite that bridge. And these are songs I wrote and recorded 20 years ago. So, you know, there's a Jitter song that was a hit song, you know, in the sense of a Jitter song being a hit song, meaning it was a mild hit. It wouldn't trouble you too much.
Buy your sailboat with those royalties, is that what you're saying?
No, I would have bought a bar of soap or something. I don't know. I was trying to think of something related to
at least
soap.
It floats.
Premium,
yeah,
soap.
Exactly. Something else floats, yeah. But the bridge really sucks. And I wrote the words, and those words really suck in the bridge. The rest of the song I don't mind. It's kind of funny, actually, but the bridge.
What is it about the bridge you don't like?
Well, I can tell you this. It's the Jitter song Closer Every Day, which was a hit, which was played by the Edmonton Oilers in 1988 when they on their road to the Stanley Cup. And whenever they hit the ice, Closer Every Day played. When they took a break, Closer Every Day played. When they scored a goal, Closer Every Day played. It was a big thing. But because those are just short little plays, it never got to the bridge. So I wasn't reminded at the time of how terrible the bridge is. But
when did you actually realize the bridge was crap? Was it like the week after the Edmonton Oilers played it, or was it just
years ago? It was probably when we finished recording it, but we were tired.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but even then I thought, well, a bridge, who cares about a bridge, you know? So, So it's a song, you know, one of your listeners, one of your viewers may know. It has a chorus that is meant to be sarcastic. It's meant to be suggestive. And it gets bigger every single time I'm near you. It gets better every single time we touch. Right? It gets bigger every single time I'm near you, you know? It's getting better every way, and it's getting closer every day. Right? So that's the chorus, and it's meant to be a big wink. It's meant to be sort of funny. But the way it was produced, it's like a pop record for kids, which was fine, but, you know. This is the bridge. I had doubts that I was getting in too deep. I was always in a daze, and I couldn't get to sleep. It's like the most obvious rhyme, sleep. But you had faith, and you always had the time. That's a good thing to say about somebody in a relationship. You know, I don't find her very attractive, and she really irritates me, but she has a lot of time for me. You know? We finally found the answer, and this is the one, and now...
Everything
is fine. It's not great. It's not amazing, but it's fine. Yeah. You know. And then that's the key change. So to me, that's a bad bridge.
But it goes into a key change, so that's exciting.
Well, yeah, but that, Neil, that isn't enough. That isn't enough. You know, everything is fine. Da-da-da. Anyway, then it goes from there. But
it's hard to know when to actually stop working on a song, you know, like, because you can, I think one of the problems, especially with everyone having a recording studio, is you'll spend the rest of your life working on the mix, on the song. Yeah. Whereas back in the old days, it's like, okay, we are in the studio next week. This is it.
That's what happened with that song. By the way, I heard a demo of that song the other day. The bridge words were way better. Way, way, way better. Oh. But in the studio, somebody cast doubt upon those lyrics. And in the studio with the producer, who was being paid to produce, and you have to take their opinion as being valuable, the producer said, yeah, I don't think those words are cutting it. So we wrote those other words, and somehow he thought the new words were cutting it better. But, you know, so we went with that in the moment, because you're paying somebody to... you know, to give you their opinion, and he thought the new words were better. They're not. But
when you get on stage now, Blair, or before COVID, whatever,
yeah,
do you feel obligated to play the bridge even though you don't like it, or do you just say, hell with it, I'm going to change it and I'm going to do what I want?
No, because changing it would actually mean putting more work into it, and it's a record that came out 35 years ago, so I sort of feel like, no, I've got other stuff I want to do. Because if I had to sit and write new words for it, I would feel like, what am I doing? Like, it's an okay song, but it's not, yeah. I mean, I don't know. And I also believe that the artist's intention is really important, even if I'm the artist, or maybe especially if I'm the artist. And my intention at the time was to put that out. There's another song of mine, One Hit Wonder, which was on an album I released in 2004. And it tells a story of Bobby Boris Pickett, the guy who wrote the Monster Mash. And I think it's really well written. I'm very proud of the song, except the bridge. Because what I'm getting at in the bridge, and I don't know if I'll even remember it, but it occurs to me every time I'm singing it live. Bobby will joke that it's all been a lark. 30 years on, he's still trapped in the dark. I'm okay with that, by the way. I'm okay with that. Meaning, Bobby Boris Pickett, because he wrote this one hit song 30 years later, he still has to go play it. That's how he makes his living. And so he's trapped. It's not necessarily a bad trap, but it's a trap. So I feel like that gets it across. And then I go, his Hollywood gang, more famous or more dead. Don't hang out with him no more, so Bobby gigs instead. Now, I have a problem with that, and every time I sing it, I think, oh, because what I'm getting at is I don't like lyrics that are particularly obscure. It's not a guessing game for me. I want to kind of tell you what I'm thinking. Now, a lot of songwriters don't, and I'm good with that. That's fine. But for me, I like to tell you. So, his Hollywood gang, more famous or more dead. Bobby Pickett hung out in Hollywood. The guy who wrote the Monster Mash hung out with Jack Nicholson and Dennis Hopper and those guys, the Hollywood sort of outlaw kind of guys. And he hung out with a guy named Phil Kaufman, and they had these incredible adventures. He hung out the guy who they burned his body at the Joshua Tree.
Hunter Thompson.
No, not Hunter. No, but
Graham Parsons.
Graham Parsons. These guys were all friends of his, and Graham Parsons. You know, the legendary story is, Phil Kaufman went to the airport in a hearse that he borrowed from somebody, and you could do this in those days because the security was very lax. And he claimed the coffin that had Graham Parsons' body in it because they didn't want it going back to Texas to Graham Parsons' allegedly unloving father. So they hijacked it and they stole it and they took it out to the Joshua Tree Monument and they burned it. And I'm alluding to all of that because Bobby Pickett was friends with those guys in those lines, but I feel like it's not enough. And I feel it sort of gets off the point. It's almost like I'm saying, wait, there's more. There's more about this guy that makes him cool. And I'm trying to fit it in these few lines. And I don't feel I did that great a job. So to this day, when I sing that song, as I'm singing the lyrics, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I should probably rewrite that. But again, it's an old song, and I've already released it. So,
Let it go. But your new song, you've got some new songs, and they've got brilliant bridges, I imagine.
They're all brilliant.
What I thought.
It's actually incessant brilliance. It gets wearing, to be honest with you. Not just
really.
Will
the record have a warning label about the excessive brilliance levels?
Yes, well, but only of the bridges. So if you want to listen to songs 2/3 of the way through up to that point, then you can bail at that point.
Right, now, it's relatively safe.
For your songwriting viewers and listeners, I would like to point out something. You can't start a song with a bridge. You can't have it after the first verse.
Is this by definition, or it's just,
Right. Well, then it's not a bridge. It's something else.
Right.
Yeah. Because a bridge is meant to be, contrary to its name, it's meant to be a break. It's not meant to be a bridge. That's a pre-chorus that would bridge the verse into the chorus.
And that's what they call them in other parts of the world. They call it the pre-chorus. What we call a pre-chorus, other places call it the bridge.
Right. Or a middle eight. Is a middle eight the same?
What we call the bridge, they call the middle eight, especially in the UK. And
and I would say the middle eight is a more accurate representation than the word bridge, because it's meant to be a break. It's meant to be a breath of fresh air. How can you have a breath of fresh air open the song? Fresh air from what?
It don't make no sense.
Yeah, you haven't played a song yet. How can you have a breath of fresh air after the first verse? You can't. How can you have a breath of fresh air after the first chorus? You kind of can't. I mean, I've done that, by the way, and I regret that too. I have many regrets. But I really believe that the ideal spot for a bridge is once the brain is a little sick of what you've already written, which would usually be a verse and a chorus and a verse and a chorus. And by then the brain's like, okay, enough. I need something new. And then you give them a bridge. That's my argument.
Yeah. I was in a band. We thought we'd be very clever and start off the song with a break. Which, so you go 1, 2, 3, 4, and then start. But no one really got it. We thought it was funny, but
you were ahead of your time, Phil.
We played to a lot of nobody.
Yeah,
we played to a lot of nobodies.
I remember I borrowed a harmonica rack from somebody once, and I made a big show of putting it on between. I don't play harmonica, and between songs, I made a big show of harmonica rack that goes around your neck. And I sort of test blowing through it to make sure it worked. And then I sang the entire song without playing any harmonica, and then I made a big show of taking it off and putting it down because I thought that was funny. But apparently nobody in the audience... See, that's the thing. They're not paying as close attention to you as you are.
No, it's true. Yeah. I would have laughed.
I did eat a sandwich that was in a harmonica brace also.
That is funny.
Yeah. So I thought that maybe I could put celery in and actually use it percussively.
That's great.
That's very, very good.
So you actually have a song, Blair, that we're going to play. So, can you tell us something about it? Well, the writing process?
Yeah. I was in Ireland, and I was telling a friend of mine about this street in my neighborhood here in Toronto, where another friend of mine had said to me, his marriage broke up, and I said, oh, no. And he said, yeah, I've moved out already. And I said, where did you go? And he said, oh, I live on this street in the East End, Cambridge Avenue. So I thought, and I didn't know where Cambridge Avenue was. It's at Broadview and Danforth. And I said, I thought to myself, that's interesting. And then I talked to somebody else a little while later, and their marriage had broken up. And I asked, what's going on? And he said, I had to move out, and I'm living on this street called Cambridge Avenue. Hmm. So that happened a couple more times, and I told my wife at the time about it. And it's because there were lots of rental apartments there that were available, and there were, I don't know, the buildings had a big turnover. So I told my wife at the time about this, and she thought it was sort of interesting and funny and odd, you know. And then we broke up. And as we're having the fight, the big fight when we're breaking up, she's really funny, and we're still friends, and I love her dearly. Don't want to be married to her. And she doesn't want to be married to me, so I'm not saying anything bad by saying that. But we had a great time being married to each other, and we produced a great child. But she has a great sense of humor, and she looked at me like through her tears, and she said, oh no, does this mean one of us has to move to Cambridge Avenue? And I thought that was so funny. And I, you know, through my own tears, I cried as well. Then we soldiered on through this painful, painful ordeal. And then a friend of mine said to me, so-and-so's got an apartment in his basement that he's not renting out. Do you want to see if he might rent it to you? And I said, yeah, where does he live? And he said, Cambridge Avenue. So I lived on Cambridge Avenue for 9 months in the basement apartment of this house. But dig this. While I was living there, a house came up for sale down the street. And Arlene, my ex, who, by the way, is a fine songwriter. I don't know if you've ever had her on, but she's really great. She bought that house, so she lives currently on Cambridge Avenue. And so I said all this to my friend in Ireland, and he said, wow, it's like Heartbreak Hotel. Like, he instantly saw the song potential. He's the kind of guy who you can say anything to. I can say, no, sorry, I can't afford to buy you that Guinness. My wallet's empty. And he'll go, my wallet's empty. And he'll start singing a song, you know, whatever. He's mm-hmm. totally Irish in that way. He'll turn something into poetry or art. So he said, we should write that song. And we did, but it took a long time, mainly because of me. He kept throwing stuff at me, and I kept going, yeah, that's good. But I was, I don't know, it was too close emotionally or something. So, you know, I finished it a year ago or so, and then started working on the recording really slowly. And this is the result.
Wow, cool.
Well, yeah, did he ever record it himself before?
No, not that I know of. No, I don't think so. No.
And has your ex heard it yet?
I don't think my son has certainly heard it because his bedroom is right beside my studio. I don't know that she has. I had to think of, like, what am I saying about Cambridge Avenue? And what I'm saying is that I finally left. Like, I had doubts about us breaking up because I loved her and I still love her and she loves me. So I had doubts about us breaking up, but it was living on my own in Cambridge Avenue that where I thought, okay, I know now what I need to do. So I put that in the song. It was where I really left her. It wasn't at the house where the marital home. It was actually after I'd already moved out, which is kind of funny. You know, it's after you moved out. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah. Arlene hasn't heard it. Arlene was never a particular fan of my music, I have to say. We weren't together because she was a groupie in any way. I don't think she ever liked my songs very much. So I haven't spent a lot of time playing my songs for her.
But that's actually something you got to consider, right? Like, you came up with Cambridge Avenue, but that's like the song is not about Cambridge Avenue. You still got to think about what the song is about, even though you've landed on a title and you know kind of what the idea behind it is. You still have to develop what the actual meat of the song is.
Well, yeah, and in this case, I didn't come up with the title so much as the concept was by my Irish friend Maurice Byrne, who really he said. he said it's kind of like Heartbreak Hotel, as I said. Mm-hmm. So that gives it the meaning. It's like, it's a street where like lonely hearts go, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that gives it the story. If it was just the name Cambridge Avenue on its own, then yeah, I'd have to be thinking like, is it a long street? Is it a wide street? Do many cars go down that street? Do children mm-hmm. play on that street? I'd have to go through all the things, but he sort of handed it to me, and life kind of handed it to me as well, really. So
that's great. Well, let's take a listen to that. Right. You want to cue that up there, Neil?
Second chances, boulevard of broken dreams. Watch the world mend its broken heart on Cambridge Avenue. Trying to sift through secrets, shape the past in what it means. It's an ordinary street, but with its own heartbeat. Revolving doors at either end. Where I really left you, though we broke up oh so long before. Cambridge Avenue is where I really left you. I had the room to finally know just what to do on Cambridge Avenue. Here's to the lonelies, well-intentioned advice, describing their own heartbreak over scotch and melting ice. They call me or they visit, they drink to buy some time. I may not wish to join them, but their heartache mirrors mine. I was ready to admit my old house key wouldn't fit. There was a new place to reside. Where I really left you, though we broke up oh so long before. Cambridge Avenue is where I really left you. I had the room to finally know just what to do on Cambridge Avenue. Time moved me on, now I can sort of smile about all those jilted ghosts and all the mixed up miles. Cambridge Avenue is where I really left you, though we broke up oh so long before. Cambridge Avenue is where I really left you. I had the room to finally know just what to do on Cambridge Avenue. I had the room to finally know just what to do on Cambridge
Avenue. And that was Cambridge Avenue by Blair Packham and
Great
Reese.
Song, Blair.
Yeah, great song.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So how long was the writing process for that?
Years. I take a long, long time to write, which is why when people ask me if I will co-write with them, I always say, you know, I'd rather not. And it's not because I don't want to write with them. It's because I don't want to let them down. And I do constantly. I really do. When people are real go-getters, it's actually a turnoff for me, and it's not their fault. They should be go-getters. Good for them. But it makes me feel ashamed of my own bad work ethic. And
you were saying before we played it that you wrote the song with Maurice Byrne. Did he get frustrated over the years that you didn't finish it?
He writes so many songs that he's with so many people that he actually didn't. He learned to stop asking me fairly quickly. But honestly, like, I have people who, the other thing is I tend to be the one who makes the demo. So they will count on me to make the demo. Well, that's a big job, you know. I want it to sound good. So then they'll call like a week later and say, "So, what do you think? Has it done anything I can hear?" And I'm like, and I'm thinking, no, because the second verse you wrote isn't as good as it could be. So we need to go back at this. And they're thinking it should be already ready, and we should be. I don't know. I'm not sure what sending it out. I'm trying to think, why the hurry? Why are you in a hurry? Aside from the fact that life is short, which I
just going to say, life is short. Oh, excuse me, Blair. I just want to say, can you take your second screen off?
The lyric?
The lyrics are still up now.
Absolutely.
Thank you. what takes so long in your rewriting, Blair? You had the idea, and as you were explaining before the song began, it seemed quite cogent, an idea. Yeah. Was it the musical structure? Was it lyrical things that you kept changing? Was there something that didn't click for you?
Lyrical changes. Am I saying it the way I want to say it? If I find myself ever thinking, and I do, by the way, but if I ever find myself thinking, oh, nobody will notice this, or I know what it means, it doesn't matter if anybody else does, then I think, no, this is what I'm doing. I'm trying to communicate with people. It matters if they get it or not. Now, it doesn't mean that I have to have every song be like instantly, like a jingle or something, instantly understandable. But it does mean that if I have that feeling in my gut that that's not quite right, I got to fix it. And I really believe that that's, you know, that's why we have those feelings, is because we know that it's not right. And sometimes I'm able to, you know, I mean, I've written some songs where I feel like every word is exactly what I want to say. But there's about three
it's
of
like
those.
If there's any doubt, there is no doubt.
Yeah. Right? So, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, yeah. And even songs that people, you know, consider my best songs or whatever, I can point out parts that I hate. But I you know, again, I've released them already, so I...
Is your approach that you finish at least a draft of the song first, or do you sort of write a verse and then come back to it later and write the chorus or something?
Yeah, it's always in bits and pieces, so it's always a verse here and a chorus there, or a line, you know, and I write them into my iPad now, but also I write them down on pads of paper. This, for instance, says, "Own it," I just like the idea of that as a song, because I was saying it to you guys in a previous show about owning your performance. And I thought, oh, wait a second. But I was also honestly thinking about own it, meaning own who I am and my flaws, including I've been thinking a lot about racism. And, you know, while it would be great to proclaim that I'm not a racist, I don't think anybody can fairly say that. And particularly people of my background, whether you mean it or not, you know, I know what my intentions are. I love people. I love everybody, you know, and I don't want conflict unless you're going to tell me what your song is about before every single song. And this gets all hard. But I really feel like owning who you are and owning your flaws is really important, particularly at a time right now. And that includes, you know, being able to talk about your flaws and trying to do better.
So, do you find that you can get back into a song? Like, I always find that if I take a long time to write a song, I can't write other songs in between. I have to finish it within like a certain amount of time. It's not one day necessarily, but if I visit a song like years later, then it's hard for me to get back into the emotional space of that.
George Harrison said that you should always finish the song. You start it, you finish it. And I think he's right. And look at George Harrison and his career and the beautiful songs that he wrote. So who am I to argue with that? I have found for myself that I am able to come back to a song later and maybe rejuvenate it, maybe have a different take on, maybe because I've grown or developed, I've ended up having a different take on something.
Yeah.
For me, it's not always about the emotion itself, like the raw emotion. But, you know, again, what I alluded to mentioning George Harrison, who am I? I don't have the final answer on any of these things, but I have the answer that works for me. And actually, I do find I can come back to something.
Yeah, and I think that's important. You got to recognize what works for you as a individual songwriter and work to your strengths, right? So if that works for you, then hey.
Yeah. I just don't want to write something and leave it all up to the listener. I have a big part in presenting this stuff, and I don't want to sort of dump it on them and then say, okay, I don't know, you figure it out. You know,
IKEA songwriting.
Yeah, exactly.
You assemble it.
Yeah, here.
Here's the Allen key.
The Allen key. But a lot of songwriters do that. You know, they feel like, okay, so here's the thing, and you guys and I have talked about this many times at this point. Why do we write songs? I always say that my students always say we write songs for self-expression. And they leave it at that. Mm-hmm. Well, if that's the case, why are you making me listen to your song? Why are you making your mom listen to your song, you know? If it's just self-expression, keep that to yourself. Express it, but don't impose it on anybody else. So I'm being flip. The why we write songs, as far as I'm concerned, is for self-expression, to be heard by other people. So because we want to be heard, we want our self-expression to be heard. Well, if that's the case, isn't it kind of rude to just give them this mystery, this obscure thing, and say, I don't know, what does it mean to you? Figure it out, you know, like. Sometimes that works, but sometimes it's an imposition. And especially in a fast-paced world where people have small attention spans, I feel like it's really self-indulgent and entitled, but that's me.
It could be the what you intended. Some people write background music. Some people want to write foreground music.
Yes.
And if you're working, and especially if you're working in a structured format, like a pop format or something, then it is more urgent, and it's kind of part of the deal to be, efficient with your words and be efficient with the way that the song takes you somewhere. You know, if you're a jam band, it don't matter,
True.
Or if you're, improvisational jazz, it's a different kind of thing.
Yeah. On the other hand, if you're really the artistic type where you're going out of your way to challenge your listener and you need them to take a deeper listen, or you at least hope that they would take a deeper listen, then you don't want the people with the short attention span. Like that's not maybe your target audience, and you actually set out with that intention. And and like you say, Blair, like maybe you don't state it like that, but you just put it out there, and whatever it ends up being.
And that's true. And don't get mad when you don't have a big audience then,
fair enough. Yeah.
You know, because again, nobody owes you a listen. Nobody. I mean, your partner, your significant other, your child, nobody owes you a listen. And so to a degree, you have to convince them. I think of every song, in a sense, as an argument or as a persuasion. You're trying to draw people in. And you're trying to give them, you're walking a whole bunch of tightropes at once. If you think about it that way, the metaphor of a tightrope, you're walking this tightrope between the familiar and the fresh. If you're too familiar, it's going to sound like somebody else's song. It's going to sound old hat, and it's going to be boring. If you're too fresh, you're not going to sound like anything anybody's ever heard before. And you know what? That isn't actually that good. Unless you're making art music. Even then, it's been done. As the Bare Naked Ladies said, it's all been done. So you're trying to balance those two things. You're trying to say some time-worn, you're trying to express some time-worn sentiments in a fresh way. Everybody's been alienated. Everybody's been hurt. Everybody's, been unhappy. Everybody's been depressed. Everybody's been ecstatic. Everyone's been, orgasmic. It's your job to find a way to express those things in a way that catches the listener's ear and makes them want to hear more. Like, tell me more, go on.
Speaking about walking those tight ropes, that's all the time we have tonight on Song Talk Radio. Special thanks to Blair Packham for coming back. Thanks, Blair.
Thanks, Blair.
How do people get more of you, Blair?
You can go to my website, which is blairpackham.com, BlairPackham.com. But you can also find me on Facebook and on Twitter and on Instagram and all over the place. I'm pretty easy to find. Bandcamp, SoundCloud, all over.
MySpace. That is great.
Yeah, even MySpace.
Even MySpace? It's cool.
Yeah.
Reverb. Don't forget to send us your impressions on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Song Talk Radio. Send us an email at feedback@songtalk.ca. And also be sure to check out the YouTube channel for these fantastic podcasts and live performances. Subscribe today to the Song Talk Radio podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher.com, Spotify, Podcast Addict, or TuneIn.com. And don't forget to sign up for the free newsletter at the site as well. You can find the links to all the products, books, and web services we mentioned here on Song Talk Radio on the resources page. And if you happen to be in the Toronto area, why don't you, or not even just want to come by the Song Talk meetup, come to the website and see what the next one's going to be. It's via Skype these days, so it's good fun for all around the globe. Special thanks to Vanessa Vreeland for keeping us on the rails. And most of all, we'd like to thank you, the home listener. You can follow Neil Modi at
neilmodi.com.
And how about you, Michael?
On Instagram, Proudfoot420.
And you can follow me at TheFillEmery on Twitter. Stop by the site at songtalk.ca to browse past shows and find out how you can be a guest on this very show. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, everyone. We'll see you next time.
Bye. Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Bye-bye.